This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Delicious and smooth tequila, made in harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Bento Box, a full-service marketing and commerce platform that helps restaurants get discovered, make more money, and engage their diners. Join over 8,000 restaurants already using Bento Box today to deliver better hospitality. Visit getbento.com/chef today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Joe Campanelli. We'll talk to Joe about his new book and more. We'll taste a Mecha Cirque wine that we'll talk about more for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Born in Queens, New York, Joe Campanelli, the kid with the Italian name, grew up with a Jewish mother. He attended NYU and studied abroad, where he found his love for Italian wine during a semester in Florence. Joe came back home with the wine bug and jumped right into retail and hospitality. He worked various jobs, including Italian wine merchants and Babbo, before opening some of the downtown New York City's best Italian restaurants, including Del Anima, Lartusi, and Anfora. He eventually packed all that in to open his own restaurants, Fausto and wine bar Lalu in Brooklyn. He also produces his own natural wine from Italy under the label Annona. Joe Campanelli has put his love and knowledge of Italian wine to great use in his new book, Vino, the Essential Guide to Real Italian Wine. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Joe.
Sam, thank you so much for having me.
All right, so we're talking to Joe. It's kind of special. Live at the Heritage Radio Network studios at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. We haven't been here in a while. Does this studio look familiar to you, Joe?
Yeah, it's wild for me to be on the other side of the microphone here. You know, I hosted my podcast In the Drink here at Heritage for 5 years or so, and I've never been a guest since I started hosting. Actually, the way I got the podcast is I was a guest on Michael Harlan Turkle's show.
Oh,
and yeah, you know, we spoke a little bit about wine, and they said, you know, we could use a wine podcast around here. And I had no, you know, aspirations, and you know, back then podcasting wasn't
very beginning.
It was very beginning.
Was that like 2014-15?
Before that,
before
even, I think 12 maybe.
That early. Wow.
Yeah, to 11 or 12. And I had no idea that we would do hundreds and hundreds of shows and that one day I'd be a guest back here again.
Well, it's good to have you here, and you look very comfortable. All right, so Joe, I want to get right into it. Give me some background on your journey in life and wine. What I want you to focus on, you know, I don't want to hear about your second grade teacher or any of that crap. I want you to focus, I guess the launching point is how that semester at NYU in Florence really had an impact, and there were people, that winemaker, you know, that had an impact on you. And then when you got back, and we talked about a little off air, a very fast, furious, and successful start in the hospitality biz at a young age. So try to cover that ground for me. Don't spend the whole show doing it, because we got to talk about the book.
Okay. I'm not going to talk about my second grade teacher, but a little bit about my childhood I think is important.
Okay.
To show why my time in Italy was so impactful. You know, I grew up in Queens, New York, as you said, as the only child of a single mom, and we never had wine on the table. We never had alcohol in the house, for that matter. And, you know, I assumed growing up that was because we were, you know, money was very tight with a single mom. And I actually found out later that my, you know, my dad passed away when I was two because he was an alcoholic as well. So I actually didn't know that until after I got into the wine industry. You know, it wasn't a thing. Grew up in Queens. I never met a farmer. I didn't, I didn't see where food was grown. I didn't meet anyone who had any like connection to their
grew in a can.
Right. That's what we thought. Grew in the supermarket. But I went to NYU. I took a class called Beverages my freshman year with a great wine teacher named Linda Lowry. And I dove into that class. It was, you know, it was an elective. It was 2 credits. It was nothing, but I loved everything about it. I loved learning about wine. I studied abroad then in Spain and Madrid for a summer between my freshman and sophomore year. And I saw there how wine was just on the table. It was like water, bread, salt, wine. You know, it was just another thing. And how it actually made the meals more enjoyable. We certainly weren't drinking anything fancy. And so I was like, I have a tiny bit of educational background. I'd see how wine can improve the experience. And then I wanted to study abroad again. I really hadn't been anywhere growing up. And so then I studied abroad in Florence. And I didn't know my Italian side of the family much growing up. And so being there, it's in some strange way, I felt connected to these people I didn't know. But what was really eye-opening for me was going to visit winemakers. I took another wine class when I was there, and Florence is 30 minutes from Chianti. It's so close. We, you know, rent a little, I remember the car was an Alfa Romeo 147. It sounds really fancy. It wasn't a fancy car. It was cheap, but it was great. And, we drive 30 minutes and go down the Strada del Vini in Chianti. And, you know, I was always convinced that the best producers weren't on the Strada del Vini. We'd have to go off the dirt road to find them, and meeting these people who were farmers first and foremost, and then were connected to their land in this way that I didn't know was possible.
So that was evident very early on, before you even sunk your teeth into it. That was one of the first impressions.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, just, I never heard people talk about their history and culture through a food product in that sort of way. And to see their connection to it, it was awesome. So when I got back from Italy, I walked into Italian wine merchants. I asked them, which was an all-Italian wine retail store on the east side of
Union Square.
And a sort of a totally groundbreaking store. There was the only store in New York, maybe the country, that had only Italian wine, and showcased them in a way that said that these wines were special. These wines were worthy of a fancy dinner.
But it had like the carpets and the dark wood, and, you know, the bottles were displayed loosely. You know, they weren't jammed in. It was like a salon almost of Italian wine.
For sure. It was like sexy. Yeah. I walked in there. I bought the second least expensive bottle of wine. There's only one bottle on the shelf, as you said. They had a dumb waiter, went down to the cellar. The wine came up. They presented it to me. It was cellar temperature for like a $14 bottle of wine. They wrapped it in beautiful paper, put it into a bag, into a nice bag that looked like you're shopping at a boutique. And it felt so good, right? And I was underage and didn't have a lot of money to spend, but they treated me so nicely. And so on my way out, I turned around and I was like, I just got back from Italy. Would you take an intern? And I don't think people interned at wine retail stores. No. Like free labor, and those are the days that you could do free labor, and they're like, sure, you know. Well, it wasn't that easy. They weren't like, sure. I had to meet with Sergio Esposito, who's the founder and the owner, they eventually hired me. But that was my first job in.
How long were you there?
I was there for a year. For pretty much my whole junior year of college.
Were you in there like 3-4 days a week?
Something like that. 3-4 days
a
week.
So it was fairly intensive.
Yeah. And I still thought...
And just absorbing everything.
just absorbing everything. It was a special place because, you know, there was the retail side of it, but there was also an events side. And I still kind of thought that I wanted to be with food. I didn't think wine was necessarily a career. I didn't mention this, but before I left for Italy, I did an internship at Union Square Cafe in the kitchen.
That's a good one.
And they're the nicest people, right? It's Union Square Hospitality. But after that, I was like, oh, I'm never going to work in a restaurant again. Like this, I'm not cut out for this. This is hard work. And so it didn't even cross my mind that this would be my career. But fast forward to Italian wine merchants, there's the retail side and then there's the event side. And I loved the events. We would open up a bunch of wine and I could tell people, I would research them during the day and then tell people about the wine. And there was a salumeria that I actually helped make salumi in a few days a week too. I did a little bit of help with the cooking. And then at night, we'd have all these open bottles of wine and I'd bring them back to my dorm at NYU. I'd bring back Quintarelli and Giacosa to a dorm.
That'd be good now.
Right? Fancy wines were being opened. And my first foray into working in Italian wine was with these really like Bartolo Mascarello, like these great wines that we think of today as sort of icons was like the, you know, I knew they were really good wines, but I didn't realize that these were like the best of the best.
Yeah, at that time. You hit the ground hard early. So they had a connection to Babbo, Italian wine merchants.
That's right.
And that comes next. You that said comes you wouldn't later. Work in restaurants. But so what happens in between?
So in between, I was at NYU. I was doing a undergrad in European studies. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. So I started taking food studies classes, which that beverages class was there.
NYU has a good food studies program.
I think so.
Very good. No, I mean, it's known for that.
And my senior year, I worked at the International Wine Center. They offered me a job there. My sophomore year, I started doing classes there. I did the intermediate sophomore year. I did advanced junior year. And then my senior year, they're like, do you want to do the diploma? If you work here, and I couldn't afford, I was already going super deep into debt with NYU. I couldn't afford to also add on more wine classes, on top of that. But they said, you know, we'll pay for your diploma class if you work at the International Wine Center. So I was like, sign me up. I really want to do this.
Awesome.
So I did that for a year and I studied abroad in Italy for a second time, came back from Italy and then worked for Vinifera Imports, which is an all Italian wine distributor. They're the first to bring in a ton of great Italian producers that we know of. And they were also, I think, pioneers. And now there's a few importers and distributors that only do Italian wine, but I believe they were the first.
Yeah.
Like
Winebo was Leonard Locascio, started as almost Italian,
right.
And then it, but you're right, there were very few specialty places.
Very few.
Yeah.
That's a very good call, actually. And then my old boss from Italian Wine Merchants, a guy named August Cardona, called me up and said, hey, I hear Babbo's looking for a sommelier. And I had never worked in a restaurant in the front of house before. And he's like, I think this would be a really good opportunity for you. And I'd be happy to put in a good word for you because, as you said before, there's that Babbo Italian Wine Merchants connection at the time. And I had read, the GM there at the time was David Lynch, and I'd read his book, Vino Italiano, cover to cover, highlighted, made notes. I didn't do that for my college textbooks. Like but for Vino Italiano, and so when I interviewed with him, it was like meeting an idol almost. I was a little starstruck. I thought he was the man. I still think David's the man.
That's good.
And, it was,
that's like the third person in an early story, Linda, I guess Serge, and now David. I mean, you had people that were good at what they did and were big influencers.
Yeah. I really benefited from people, for whatever reason, seeing something in me and then sort of encouraging me.
Oh, it's not a coincidence.
But really, yeah, Linda and August. And I know August was on the board here at Heritage for a while.
I remember, years ago. So how long are you at Babbo?
Not a long time.
And when you got there, it wasn't dedicated particularly to just wine, right? Or was it?
I was a sommelier.
You were. Oh, right.
Yeah, I was,
right.
20, I was went, 23
you,
years old.
They called you a sommelier. Right.
They called me a sommelier.
And like everything else, you were serious about it and dedicated yourself.
Yeah. I didn't realize at that time that being a sommelier in a busy restaurant wasn't only about wine. I was like, oh, I'm a sommelier. And you really need to be part of the team. But I think that's from my lack of experience.
Have you ever read the book Heat?
Oh, yeah.
That was your gig. All right, so I want to get to the book, but we have a big part to fill in. So get me from leaving Babbo, and I think it happens pretty quickly. You get involved, like at a super young age, in the restaurant business in a scene that is like incredible.
Right. Well, that there, same
you another per right. Go ahead.
That same former boss of mine, friend of mine, August, who got me the recommended me for the job at Babbo. Also, later that year said, hey, would you want to open up a restaurant together? And that ended up being Del Anima in 2007. So I was 23 and I lived direct. I had a tiny, tiny studio apartment above Del Anima, lived right above it. And that was in 2007, Lartuzzi in 2008, and then Anfora in 2010.
All hits, right?
They did well, yeah. Thankfully.
I mean, Del Anima, when you opened it, was pretty much a hit from the beginning, right?
Yeah. I think the real impetus for Lartuzzi was just that we were turning away more people at Del Anima every night than we were sitting.
Is that crazy?
Yeah. And so that's why Lartuzzi was not that far away and not that different of a concept, but bigger and more approachable in certain ways. But we just needed more. We needed more seats.
I know you've been away from it for years, mm-hmm. but I think they just opened Bartuzzi.
Yeah.
Which Bartuzzi made sense. So all these restaurants, you were heavily involved with probably what people thought was an interesting, well-curated, kind of newer look wine list, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was the operating partner and beverage director of these restaurants. And what I wanted to do at Del Anima was focus on indigenous grapes. And that was something that I was passionate about. I took a class with Ian Dagata while I was studying abroad in Italy. And when hearing him speak about indigenous grapes, it was really influential to me. And so my first list at Del Anima really focused on, there were a couple of wines in the early years that didn't have it. But then as I went on, I went even more and more down that. I actually told Ian about this later, about how influential that was. And he told me that I wasn't the first one of his former students to open up a restaurant and do an all indigenous,
wow.
which I didn't know.
So cool. Just for the listeners, just describe to them in this context what an indigenous grape is. Because a grape is, to a lot of listeners, a grape's a grape.
Well, this is one of the things I think is so interesting and exciting about Italy and Italian wines, is that they have more indigenous grapes than probably anywhere else. An indigenous grape is a wine that is really, it's grown in the place that it comes from, that it originates from. And, I love Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and Syrah, and those grapes grow absolutely all over the world. And I think there are really great examples all over the world. But Italy has more grapes that are just native to that place than anywhere else. And for me, that's the best way you can really get an insight to the culture, the heritage, the taste of that land.
We're going to get into that when we talk about the book. But let's finish the front end. So you open the three restaurants with success. We don't have to get into detail. But, after years, for a lot of different reasons, it's time to move on. And you open your own restaurant fairly quickly after you leave the other guys?
Yeah. I left that group in 2016 and then 2017 opened up Fausto.
Right. And what I want to do is talk about Fausto a little towards the end of the show. I want to jump into the book. So let's do that.
Okay.
So I need to get some obligatory questions out of the way, right? So here they are. And I'll remind you if you forget them. Why write this book? You didn't have to. You did. Why now? Based on what we talked about, you could have done it a few years ago. You could have waited. And when did the idea come together, you know, firmly? So tell me how the project got.
So I wanted to write this book because, well, first and foremost, I love Italian wine and have dedicated my career to Italian wine.
Well, the lead up to this wasn't evident, yeah. You know.
And I've done, so, whether it's distributor, restaurant, I've done some retail. Writing articles in retail, a lot of different, and then you mentioned before I was involved in a wine project, producing wine. Really writing a book about it is something I haven't done yet. But also, Italian wine is the most imported wine into the United States. And I do not think there's enough voices, there's enough written about Italian wine that's current, that reflects the way people drink today and also what's going on in Italy, at least in book form. I think and I hope that there will be a lot more books on Italian wine, that you know, that this won't be the only one for a few years. I hope that we'll see more and more because it's such a big and diverse topic and there's room for a lot of points of view. And I think it was sort of just time for a new book on Italian wine.
I agree. I mean, it's the most imported wine, but we're going to get into, there's more varietals, as you alluded to, you know, before. So you decided, how long did it take you to write it?
It took some time. I wrote the proposal in 2018, and then we shopped it around. I think we sold it at the end of 2018, and then started writing it in middle of 2019 or so, and then handed it in at the middle of 2020.
Wow.
Yeah. And certainly the...
a COVID book.
I guess the middle of 2020 was when we handed it in. Yeah, COVID kind of messed with things because I had a couple more trips that I was planning on. I had to do all of that that I couldn't go on. I had to do all of my meetings with my co-author, Joshua David Stein, virtually. Different dynamic, yeah. I went with a photographer to Italy before the pandemic, but then after the pandemic, luckily he was based in Italy and he was able to do some of the stuff on his own and was able to help coordinate. But I really enjoyed our trip to Italy together. I would have loved to travel more with Otter throughout.
Yeah. How did you, when you decided to write it, how did you want to differentiate this book from other books and other books on Italian wines? Because you and I know probably in the last 2-3 years, a lot of good people, you know, whether it's Aldo Somme or Raj Parr, they wrote some really good books. You know, when you sat down, it's like, I don't want to just write a book. I want to write, you know, a definitive book. How, you know, what did you want to do to differentiate?
Yeah. And I agree with you. Raj's books and Aldo's book are great. And I benefited from... My editor worked on Aldo's book.
Okay.
So all of the knowledge that Aldo taught my editor, I'd asked her, I was like, how do you know to ask these questions? Her name's Jennifer Sitt at Clarkson Potter. And she just asked the smartest questions or make the best edits. And I was like, how do you know? And she's like, well, I worked with Aldo. And so that was really a crash course for her. I'm sorry. I was giving Jen props and forgot what your question
was. How do you want to differentiate?
Oh.
You know, I mean, like I said, if you just wanted to write a book, okay. But I mean, your passion for Italian wine, it's like, we don't want another Italian wine book. So what was your thinking?
Well, I think it's the book is definitely my personal point of view and based on my personal experience. I think there's great wines that I've left out just because in all of my travels to Italy, and I've been to Italy every year, multiple times a year, except for these past couple because of the pandemic. But you know, it's very personal. It's also not meant to be encyclopedic. It's not meant to cover every single grape. We mentioned Ian D'Agata and his book, The Native Grapes of Italy, was a huge resource for me, but that is a lot more information. This I want to be more of a story that you can read. I wanted to be a little bit more of a travel and wine book at the same time. Something you can pick up, open up a chapter, open up a glass of wine, and enjoy it.
It's the good news is it's somewhat encyclopedic, but it doesn't feel heavy and encyclopedic. But the information's there. I mean, don't undersell the detail you get into with grapes. You know, because when you add up all the regions and how many grapes are in each region, it's like, Jesus, you know, and we'll understand why with Italy. Tell me if you agree with me. I think because of you and your experience, your age and all this, I would kind of call this a contemporary take, you know, on Italian wine. It's definitely updated and current, but you said it's personal in a story. And, you know, do you agree? I mean, is that one of the things you wanted to accomplish?
For sure. I want this book to be contemporary. Like, what is going on today in Italian wine? What are the things that wine enthusiasts like you and myself are talking about, are drinking? And so I included, things that maybe you haven't seen in previous Italian wine books, like discussions of Pet Nat or orange wines.
There's a whole section on emerging styles.
Emerging
styles. Which we're going to talk about. the good news, I guess, is I had Jancis Robinson on the last show, and she just finished her eighth, you know, atlas. So you can update this, you know, every few years. And, you know, that's a good thing for you. And they'll probably...
It's a big step down from Jancis.
No, that wasn't my point. I wasn't propping me up or putting you down. What I'm saying is this is the type of book that 5 years from now, the world in Italy will look a little different, you know, and you want to keep it contemporary. All right. So I read the book. You know, I loved it. It was an easy read in a good way. Not easy like fast and I got rid of it. It was something I enjoyed, the way it was formatted. So you take a very specific and personal approach to how you perceive wine. And the beginning of this discussion is a little nerdy, you know, so let's get through it quickly. I think the best way to set the book up is, because you set it up this way, is there's this appellation system of Italian wines, or an organization of how, you know, they categorize wines. Just talk about that a little. And it kind of drove you crazy, you know, to the point where you had to rethink, wait, you know, that's there, let it be. But here's how I perceive it. So just tell me about, you know, the categorization. Don't get too nerdy.
Okay. Yeah, so Italy has a system of organizing wines that's based on the French system. In Italy, they call it the DOC, or Denominazione di Origine Controllata system. And at the very top of this pyramid is a DOCG, which presumably should be the very finest wines in Italy. And then the next would be the DOC, which, maybe a step down, but has a lot of the same controls at C-part that the DOCG does. And then IGT, and then at the bottom, Vino di Tavola. And when I say it's based on the French system, it's based on this appellation system. And the theory, I think, is really great. And the theory of an appellation is that if you put the name of something on a bottle of wine, on a cheese, on beans, even, you know, it should taste like it comes specifically from that place. It putting the name on it means that the name means something. It means as a specific history, culture, flavor.
And requirement, you know, Chianti's got to be 80% Chianti, whatever. You know, there's a uniformity or a requirement.
Right. And you sort of know to some extent what you're getting.
Right.
You know, and I think, yeah, some of the best wines, some of my favorite wines really do fit into this system. But my challenge is that a lot of times the system is too loose, and you can have someone making a true artisan product with all native grapes, all indigenous grapes, that tastes like the place it comes from. And that's a DOCG wine. Or you can have someone making an industrial wine with French grapes, purchased yeast, like a ton of manipulation, and that could also fit into the DOCG and taste like it could be made anywhere in the world. And so to me, that this system was not a system that that really sort of legislated the kind of wines I was most interested in.
So let's move forward, because you obviously didn't like it and have a disagreement. So you and the book lays it out, and I think this has been percolating in your head for many years. You have a more holistic approach, and it's the infamous 3 V's, you know, which anywhere I go, that's all people talk about is the 3 V's. You know,
very kind of you to say.
which is vino, vero, ven. So first explain, you know, what vino, vero, ven is, and just get into each thing. And I think in reading it, I agree totally. I almost think you need to add like an S, because I think the story is just as important and all that. But talk to me about vino, vero, ven, which I think is terrific.
Thank you so much. And I should give credit to my co-author for Joshua David Stein for sort of coming up with the idea of the vino, vero, ven, because we were having these conversations about what are the wines that are most interesting and most important to me, and the wines that express my theory behind wine, and what makes it that way. And I said, well, you have to start with wine made in a natural way. But saying it's natural wine to me was just a little reductive. Like, you can make natural wine in Staten Island or in Queens, where I grew up, but if you're not a good winemaker and it's not good land and it's not a good grape, like, it doesn't matter that it's a natural wine. So that's just one part of it. You also have to have the right, you have to have the right grapes, the grapes that are made, that are in Italy, indigenous grapes, because those are the ones that are going to be the most expressive. Those are the ones that are going to tell you the most about the place that it comes from. And then you have to have a talented winemaker who, because it takes nature, it takes the grape, but also takes a human in order to translate and do that physical work. And you have to have someone who has an understanding of what they're doing. And so then in the middle of all of these things, where it overlaps, where you have the right grapes, natural winemaking, talented winemaker in the middle, then that's the center of the vino, vero, ven to me.
Right. So native grapes, let's break it down, each one. Native grapes, you mentioned indigenous grapes. I think in Italy there's 2,000 plus varietals. I think from my perspective, you know, and you're the expert, is there's just been so much attention towards Super Tuscans and, you know, all this other stuff that we forget about all these varietals, and all the attention, you know, goes to the bigger grapes. So I think, you know, the book does a good job talking about the native grapes, where they're made, you know, the 20 sections and all of that.
Thank you. And I think that's been a big sea change in the last 20 years in Italy. Whereas 20 years ago, a lot of winemakers, for their top wine, they'd use half an indigenous grape and throw half Cabernet Sauvignon and put it in a French oak barrel. And that was their fanciest wine. And I found that I was always drawn to like the second fanciest wine, which would be the one that's made more traditionally with all indigenous grapes. But right now, I think Italians are getting more and more comfortable with the fact that what they have to offer is unique, and anyone can throw 50% Cabernet.
Well, they're, you know, as you said, they're embodying and reflecting the terroir. You know, so the grape is indigenous. They're not just making an indigenous grape. To the third V, they're making it, you know, artisanally. I mean, you had said it earlier, there's a big debate on what natural wine is and how you define it. I think for me, you helped me, because I think vino, vero, ven sort of is another way to look at wines, and, you know, that how they're natural. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah,
I mean that was definitely part of your thought process.
It was. And to me, making wine in a natural way, making wine without chemicals, should be a baseline. Like, I don't want to ingest chemicals. And, you know, I learned a lot about that when I got my master's degree in food studies at NYU, like all of the different agrochemicals and what they can do to your body. I don't want to ingest that. But as a wine lover, that's not enough. Like, it's got to be a baseline. And then you also really need a talented winemaker, and you need great terroir. And when you have those three things together, then you can find something special.
I don't think two out of three works all the time either, you know. So in defining natural wine, why even seek to find a definition, right? I mean, you've sort of come to your own comfort zone where these three things really, you know, define what a good wine is. All right, Joe, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about, you know, the guts of the book. I want to talk about, you know, the regions and emerging styles, you know, and I want you to get into the specifics. I think our listeners crave to hear, you know, specific stuff from you. We're talking to Joe Campanelli. We're talking to Joe about his new book, Vino. You're listening to The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainability-managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Did you know that over 70% of diners research a restaurant online before ordering from or going in person? Your digital front door is more important than ever. Let BentoBox design and build you a beautifully branded website. BentoBox websites provide sleek design and seamless content management, creating impactful first impressions and converting visitors into customers. And with built-in commerce and marketing tools like online ordering, gift cards, automated email, and more, you can also grow your revenue and keep your diners coming back. Join over 8,000 restaurants that leverage BentoBox to power their digital presence and deliver great hospitality. Visit getbento.com/chef today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Joe Campanelli. We're talking to Joe about his new book, Vino. So, Joe, one of the things that I noticed in the book that's really important to the book, to you, and to Italian wine is there's been a significant generational change. And I think the generational change is carrying on the good practices of the older generation, or they're aware that the practices weren't good. Tell me about, you know, the generational change. I mean, all like the Foradoris and the Pepe, you know, there's some great people out there.
Yeah, I mean, I can think of the generational change in Italy. It's, you know, you're so right about the new generation bringing new interest, new ideas. And I hear this story kind of time and again where every generation sort of rebels against their parents. So the grandfather was making maybe wine in a very old school, traditional way, kind of organically, by hand, artisanally. The father then buys the most modern equipment and makes the most modern wines. And now increasingly the daughter takes over, or son, and is kind of going back to the more artisan way of doing
yearns
things.
Yearns for grandpa.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Those things like the way grandpa did. So that's happening a lot as well.
That's interesting. Because it can go either way. I mean, they could stay the course and go modern, or they can go back to other values. And we'll talk about that. All right. So We're going to talk about some specific wines, wineries, and the generational change will fit in. So most people, when they think of Italian wines, unfortunately, because we've talked about how many varietals and, you know, we're going to get into regions, they think of Tuscany and Barolo. But beyond the other regions, there's emerging styles. And before we get into the regions, I want to talk about emerging styles, which I think has caught your attention, and I think you spend a lot of time, you know, talking about them. So I think you talk about 5 or 6 emerging styles. I want to get into a few of them. For me, it's hard not to ignore orange wines. So give the listener a little primer on, you know, what an orange wine is, and let's talk about some makers in the regions that are.
Yeah, so an orange wine is basically a wine that starts with white grapes and then sees a maceration of the skins. So you can also call it a macerated wine, but that might be overly simple because...
Maceration is when the grape is in the tank, the whole fruit in the liquid.
Yep, the skin right. And the liquid are together. And, if you start with a white grape, normally white grapes, they remove the skins to make a white wine or have a very, very short maceration, but... if you want to do an orange wine, you use those white grapes and then you have a longer maceration and you're pulling out some color, some flavor, and some tannin, some texture, you know, depending on the grape, making an orange wine. And this wasn't really a style in the Western world, until Jasko Grosvenor, in the very late 90s, along with some of his contemporaries up in Friuli, decided that this was something that they wanted to explore.
What's amazing, it's a fairly young, you know, thing. You mentioned that you really didn't taste orange wines until, you know, 2005.
Right. My first one was, I remember it at Italian Wine Merchants. It was Grosvenor's first, I believe it was the first release of orange wine in New York.
Oh, really?
And just looking at the color and staring at the color and thinking there was this like inner glow in it and just being amazed by
right.
it. And no one knew, you know, it was with all of these wine experts, everyone who
was there me. Hype with the wine coming in, or it showed up and everybody said, what's this, and self-taught, or?
You know, I remember there being hype from my colleagues. Everyone's like, oh, we're going to taste this new Grosvenor release.
So it was this
so
thing.
Weird. And- yeah. And then when I opened up my first restaurant, Delanima, I had orange wine by the glass, but no one knew what it was. We had to give it away. And
really?
I've always had it by the glass. And
if you don't have it now.
Now, if you don't have it, yeah, we have 2 by the glass at, or 3 sometimes at Lalu. And people want it, you know, all year round. I feel like I was pushing orange wine and pushing the style for so long. And now I very rarely want to drink. I have to be like in the mood to drink it.
I know. Well, what's interesting, as you said, is it started with a couple of influential makers in, what is it, northeast Italy?
In Friuli. Yeah.
Which is close to, what, Slovenia?
That's right.
You know, so there was that, you know, dual influence and all that, Radicon. So they set the trend. Now everybody makes it.
Yeah.
Right?
And it makes sense that it started there because there is history in that area of skin macerating white grapes.
And the type of grapes that are indigenous to the area.
They do well. Ribolla does really well with it.
I mean, are we going to see like a Sutter Home orange wine? I mean, is the world going to get to that?
I think so. I think
that
you'll
sucks,
start to
right?
see like industrial orange wine. I'm sure it's happened already. I don't know of it, but I'm sure there'll be industrial orange wine or industrial pet nat. You can even make industrial natural wine.
Yes. That's unfortunately when we try to define things. I mean, things are not going in the right direction that way. All right. So that's orange wine. There's, you know, we broached it. There's a deep history and, you know, we mentioned Grosvenor and Radicon, but there's, you know, some also good makers. You also take some time to take what is probably an underappreciated and misunderstood area, which is sparkling wines. You know, champagne and sparkling wines, I think you'd agree with me, are more popular now than ever. I mean, who knew you'd walk into an Italian pizza restaurant and there's like 40 champagnes or something? I mean, that didn't happen. So get into get into some of the sparkling wines of Italy that you cover. Everybody knows Prosecco, but I mean, there's a whole world of, you know, just like great grapes and makers, there's great sparkling ones.
And you're right. There's been a sparkling wine revolution in the wine world. But I think especially in Italy, when I started in the industry, it was Prosecco, Moscato d'Asti, and Franciacorta. And Moscato can be very tasty, but it's a very specific application. And Franciacorta, it just was never my favorite wine because I always felt you could spend a couple of dollars more and get champagne, and champagne was very similar, but a lot better.
So just clarify that for me. That means Franciacorta was okay, but it wasn't cheap. It
wasn't cheap.
At least Prosecco, you can get a cheap bottle and a buzz. Right. But Franciacorta, so why not step up a few bucks to champagne? All right. So
and then I'd never had Prosecco at my restaurants. I was like, everyone knows Prosecco. And for me, especially one of the things that I loved about wine so much was the sense of discovery. So I wanted to have sparkling wines even. If someone wanted Prosecco, it's like, we don't have Prosecco, but we got Lambrusco Bianco. Like, and they'd be like, Lambrusco Bianco, what's that? And having that moment of discovery, I loved it, and I wanted to share that with people. But it was so hard and limited then to find interesting sparkling wine. And Italy has dramatically changed. Indigenous grape sparkling wines, so delicious. I just tried, I did a book event on Sunday at Slope Cellars, and they opened up a Furlani Alpino from Trentino, and it's made from the Nozziola grape. And boy, this is a pet nat wine for like $20, $25 retail. And it was expressive. It was complex. It was delicious. We just kept drinking it. Like, I couldn't stop drinking. It was such a good wine. And there just weren't sparkling wines that long ago in Italy that said something about where it came from.
So cover the bases. They're making pet nats. They're making Prosecco still. Lambrusco, they make Lambrusco Bianco. But the art form of Lambrusco has elevated. They're making method champenois, or in Italian, what do they call it?
They call it metodo classico.
Right.
Metodo classico.
Which so is making that.
Making that from indigenous grapes too, which I think it makes some really cool wines. Like Coast down in Sicily is doing one. Ferrando up in Carema is making one from Erba Luce. And then, you know, using a lowly old school heirloom traditional Italian grape in this very expensive time consuming process of the metodo classico or champagne method. I think that's interesting. And those are some expressive wines, but you really covered it. Pet Nat's the big change, and you can have some really tasty, expressive wines at a low cost. Metodo Classico is going to be more expensive because it's more time consuming, but those can be really expressive. And Lambrusco has increased the quality. I feel like every year you're like, you see an article, Lambrusco is really worth drinking.
Pizza wine.
And now for me, the biggest coup is that I'm proud to have Prosecco at the restaurants because there's even been
artisan makers using indigenous grapes.
In Prosecco too.
Vino Vero Ven.
Yeah.
Right. So just for my thick head, they're using the champagne method to double ferment with indigenous grapes. Because everyone knows champagne is predominantly Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir, what am I missing?
Chardonnay
and
Pinot Meunier.
They're using the same method with indigenous grapes.
Right.
So the range of what's interesting is unbelievable. And in the book, you get into pretty good detail about makers and all that, which is a nice thing about the book. We'll get into that. All right, the last thing on emerging things I want to talk about is, again, when people think of Tuscany and Barolo, people, when they think of Italy, think of red wines probably first. You do a section on something we talked about a little, which is ageable whites. You just can't take a white wine and put it away. You know, you have to create a wine that's ageable. Talk to me a little about, you know, what an ageable white Italian wine is, why it's ageable.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're asking about this one in particular, because I still find that a lot of people I speak to think of Italy as having great red wines now and maybe like throw away whites, you know, and they don't realize
that's my point.
That the white wines, when they're made well, can be so expressive. And it, yeah, it's not just age-worthy whites, but the idea that Italy has world-class white wines that are expressive and are super delicious. So I think of it kind of two things. There's been sort of a trend of producers aging their white wines at the cellar for a long time and then releasing them late. Like I can think of like San Lorenzo in Verdicchio at Castel di Iesi. They make a wine called Il San Lorenzo that they age on the lees for 8 years before releasing, which is wild. And those wines, especially in cooler vintages, can be like really beautiful. Or producers like, there's a producer, Colle Catone, they make a wine called Colle Gallo that they age. It's a white wine from Malvasia in Lazio. And I think their current release in New York is like 2007 vintage. It's a white wine from Italy and it's beautiful. I think that there's been this sea change. Oh, then I guess the third way is someone just making a really high quality white wine that they release young, but happens to be super age worthy. Like, I just drank, Fonte Canale from Tiberio a few days ago. It was a 2018 vintage, which was their current release. But boy, if that wine could age 10 or 20 years, I wouldn't be surprised. It was really beautiful.
So I think when people think Italian wines, they should think white too. And, you know, a nice summer Vermentino or something is terrific. But there's also white wines that are aged with body that could sit in your cellar. So that's part of the book. And, you know, that should influence people.
And if you're just starting a cellar, I think good quality Italian white wines are a good place to go because they're not going to cost that much compared to other aged wines.
So if we have time.
Yeah.
Joe, if someone was putting together a case of Italian wines to enjoy this summer, give me some recommendations. And I don't mean just summer wines. I mean just, you know, ageable wine, all that. But we'll get to that.
Okay.
Because I don't want to jump to that right away. All right. So we talked about orange wines. We talked about sparkling wines. We talked about ageable white wines, which are some of the chapters, Joe. You know, there's Rosati, Rosé, and other ones. But I wanted to get into that because I thought those were interesting. I mentioned off air that it's going to be tough to talk about an important part of the book, which is how you get into detail with 20 different regions, which I think is the bulk of the book and the beauty of the book. And just explain how it's set up. You get to each region and you kind of get a dose of this. Tell everyone, you know, what they're getting. So you go to Trentino Alto Adige or Tuscany, and in each chapter you'll get.
Yeah, and so Italy has 20 different regions. We can kind of think of them as states here in, you know, in the United States, and each one of them makes wine and makes unique wine from their own indigenous grapes. And so each region, we start with writing about what is going on in this region now. What's most the current topics, give an idea a little bit about the geography and the history of the region, but not too much. It's more about what's really current. And then I write about the most influential producers, the ones who are really of the moment and pushing the conversation forward, and the most important indigenous grapes.
Right. And that's constant throughout each region. And there are regions everyone heard of, and probably there's a few that people haven't, you know. There's Tuscany and Piedmont. I don't know how much people know about Valdosta, you know. So everything is covered. Can't get into every one of them, but I'll ask you the base fun questions. Where, when you look at those regions, where are the most exciting wines today coming from?
Wow, it's
think
hard,
about no, I know, and then maybe there's 2, 3, 4, you know, answers. But what have you been buying more of lately? Who's impressed you? You know, when you think about who you fawn over, who is it? Where they're from? You know, that's how to answer that question.
I mean, there's no doubt that Sicily is like the most or one of the most dynamic places for winemaking in Italy, and it's been constantly changing for the last 20 years, ever since like the the rebirth on Mount Etna, and what Ariana Occhipinti is doing down in Vitoria area, and then even up in the Northwest in Marsala, there, you know, with Marco de Bartoli and Nino Baracco, and just a bunch of interesting wines from a place even in Sicily that we didn't necessarily think, you know, that would be the spot. So Sicily's the obvious answer. I think maybe the less obvious answer is Lazio, where Rome is the capital.
L-A-Z-I-O.
L-A-Z-I-O, Lazio.
People may think there's a T in there.
Yeah.
right.
You have the this great indigenous grape, Cesanese, which is...
Spell C-E-S...
A-N-E-S-E.
Cesanese the grape. Okay.
Cesanese the grape.
So we look all this up.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And I kind of think of Lazio, you know, if you... there's a lot of young winemakers there as well. And if you want to start a new vineyard, you're not buying a vineyard in Barolo. It's too expensive and there's nothing available, even if you had the money. But in Lazio, you can buy some a great vineyard on volcanic soil or close to a lake. And there's some other, there's like new, like young, exciting producers you can share ideas with, and you can experiment. You can take some risks, and it's not,
it's cool.
It's a cool area. Yeah.
It's funny you say Sicily, because when I read the book, I said, you know what? Let me go to each chapter and count how many pages he devoted. And of course, Piedmont got a lot of pages. Tuscany got a lot of pages. But I think Sicily was like third or fourth. I mean, it just went on and on and on, which, you know, makes sense to your answer. What about, in the same vein of questioning, what about a more traditional area that's, you know, doing some cool stuff? Does anything come to mind? Eric Asimov can't stop talking about Chianti for the last 3 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of what came to my mind, too. And even think of, like, you know, like Panzano, which is where Fontodi is located, and Monte Bernardi and Rampola. They're turning that into a totally green zone with no pesticides, even on the side of the road. And how cool is that? So I think that's, Tuscany is sort of reinventing itself. And in Barolo too, like when I first started going to Barolo, you'd see no grass between the vines at all, right? And it seems these days it's a lot more alive. There's a lot more organic producers there. And there's grass between the vines.
But also varietals. I mean, you thought of Barolo as Barbaresco, Barolo, Barbadala, you know, that, you know, now there's Lange and Pella Vergas. Am I pronouncing it right?
Pella Verga.
You know, there's some cool varietals.
I guess you could say, you're reminding me too that, you know, Alto Piemonte, the northern part of Piedmont,
right,
is a really exciting area. And there's still, you know, there's a producer named Cristiano Garella, who has really been such a big champion for the area. And he has his own label, Colombaron Garella, is with his partner, and has consulted on a bunch of others. And Roberto Conterno bought the Nervi estate.
Right.
And so we're further up north, a more acidic soil. It's a little bit cooler. And you can, it's this a lot of times the same grape as you see in Barolo, but at a lower alcohol level,
right,
less expensive, doesn't need to be aged as long. And
so there's stuff going on that's worth paying attention to.
I think so. Yeah. Alto Barolo. Piemonte for sure.
So you've traveled, you've drank, and you wrote about these regions. If I had to say to you, if we had to go to one or two regions to find the best values, because let's say my kids are intrigued by this interview, but you know, they're not going to buy, you know, Conterno Mascara. What regions do you look for? And generally, you know, if you look at the book and look at maybe the dozen winemakers, what comes to mind?
Yeah. Well, I think that Campania whites, especially from the Fiano and Greco grapes, more so than Falanghina. I like Falanghina too, but Fiano and Greco, like, you can have very complex mineral-driven white wines for $20 retail, $20 to $25 retail.
Above that price point.
I think way, way above that price point.
About red?
And then for reds, there's so many. I think, I almost think any obscure Italian red grape made by an artisan winemaker, it's not going to be that expensive and is going to be pretty delicious.
It's kind of built in that that's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, you go to an artisanal small winemaker to a region and he's growing indigenous grapes and vinting them. It's going to be good.
Yeah. I really like this grape called Schiava from up in Trentino Alto Adige. It's a very light skinned, medium bodied red grape. And in the summer, it'd be really good with a chill too. But I think they max out at $25 retail maximum.
Those are good ones. Last question on the regions. Is there any region where there's really a story, like in the last, like something that sticks out? I mean, obviously, when you answered the other question with Sicilian wine, Sicily certainly fits that category. But is there anything going on in any region? I guess you could say orange wines in the Northeast. You know, any other story that just writing the book stuck out?
Oh God, there's so many stories. That is the essence of Italian wine, is that there's so many stories. And my team at Dell'Anima used to make fun of me because I would always say that my favorite wine is a wine with a good story. And I feel like if it's a wine made by a person, by
Vino Vero Vin,
right, an artisan wine, then that's a good story. You're talking about a family. It's not a big corporation. But I think what's emblematic of the story of Italian wine is what's going on Mount Etna, in a way, in that you had this jewel that was right in everyone's backyard. People have been going to Taormina forever, since ancient Roman times. It's always been a fancy place to go. And when you're in Taormina, you look up and you see Mount Etna. And Mount Etna has ancient, ungrafted, bush-trained Nerello Mascalese vines that make some of the most expressive, beautiful wines in the world. And other than Benanti, people weren't really doing it until Frank Cornelessen came, and then Andrea Franchetti, and so on and so on. And that was only 20 years ago. And now people realize, wow, Etna, there's so much to offer from this native grape, Nerello Mascalese, making wine in an artisan method, which is the only way you can do it with bush-trained vines. They're low-yielding. You can't mechanize on those hills. And now Italy realizes, a lot of Italian producers realize, this is what we have to offer the world, not another Cabernet Sauvignon.
That is a good story, and that is a good region, and those are great wines. All right, we have to address a few things. You have to do the wine list. I want to taste this wine and talk about it, but I want to revert back to two things. Do this quickly for me. Put a case of wine together for me. Let's say three bottles each, four different wines, range of price, nothing too crazy on the high end. Obviously, there's no crap on the low end. What am I bringing out to the beach?
Do you want to do
Hey, you're the guy who wrote about Rosati, sparkling, ageable, you know, just go.
There's so many.
Do this for a living, and now you're like shell-shocked?
Yeah, you know, if there were just a couple of options, it would be a lot easier.
Right.
my go-to white wine is, my house white wine is the Ciro Picariello Fiano 906, a single high elevation vineyard. It tastes like salt water and...
With shellfish, seafood.
Yes.
Good acidity for food.
You can sip it on its own, which Italian wines are
so
made for food.
So that's one of your whites?
That's one of my whites. I love
the... Sparkler or rosé?
Let's do the rosé, the De Fermo. It's called Le Cinche, and the appellation is Cerisuolo d'Abruzzo. It's a rosé made from the Montepulciano grape. And this is a rosé with personality. It is a rosé with character. I absolutely love this
Where
wine.
Where does it fall retail?
Probably high 20s, I would say.
So it's a good quality. All right, so now we have two SKUs. We need a couple of reds. Probably a crunchable red, which we had mentioned before, and maybe a traditional red. I mean, some of the Sicilian reds have nice body.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a hard time not always recommending the Arianna Occhipinti's Frappato. I buy that wine by the case.
Okay, that's great. I mean, people should be drinking that. So that's one. Give me another one.
And then a more structured, sort of a bigger red also?
Yeah.
Let's do...
You can't leave the Italian category without throwing one of
those. You know, if you're doing something a little bit more traditional, there's a new producer in Barolo named Giulia Negri, and she is a rock star. She is a very, very high elevation vineyard. It's above Brico delle Viole, which is Giuseppe Vira's high elevation vineyard, and hers is just a little bit higher up the hill. And she spent some time in Burgundy and takes a Piemontese Burgundian approach to her winemaking, and those wines are so beautiful. I would do her
N-E-G-R-I?
N-E-G-R-I.
Negri.
And it's just rare to find a new, like a young new winery in Barolo, and she's like all of 30 years old and she's killing it.
Something to look out for. All right, before we get to our two last features, let's talk about your restaurants. You're celebrating 5 years at Fausto. Lalu, the wine bar, came a little after. That's a big deal in New York. That's a big deal in the middle of COVID. Would you say these restaurants are a canvas for you to get all this love and these Italian wines out there? I mean, what better, right?
I don't know about a canvas for love, but they're, I feel like we're able to really sort of vote with our dollar in a way and support the farmers that we really care about. And so,
but that's what I meant. Food,
yeah.
I mean, your love is, it's, we've talked about, you know, the winemaker, their process and all of that. So you're able to carry that through.
Yeah. And it's like an honor. Honestly, it's an honor to, it's so they do the hard work. I just buy the wine and, you know, tell the story about it.
I know, you know, podcasts are time sensitive, but I know you're doing, are you doing an event or you're having, is it Pepe in or?
I have
Chiara.
Chiara Pepe, the granddaughter.
That's a big deal.
Media is going to be at Fausto on Monday.
Right.
We just had Beatrice Buontempo, who's the daughter of Stella di Campalto.
Who makes some of the most stunning, you know, Tuscan wines.
I agree. That's one of my favorite.
That was a nice grab by you. And I want to mention your chef and partner, Aaron Chambord, is baking incredible food to pair and, you know, to be compatible with these wines.
That's true. And then we just, you know, we had some staffing issues during COVID, and we're just now in a good place. And so she's finally fired up the wood fire ovens at Fausto once
there
again.
You go.
So it's tasting good there. Yeah.
So look for Fausto and Lalo in Brooklyn. I'll give you at the end of the show where you can find that. All right, Joe, the Grape Nation wine list, 5 questions. I added a 6th for you. Don't obsess over these quickly. All right. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? What's in your fridge at home? What are you tasting for the restaurant? Seasonal changes? Give me a couple of answers to that.
So, you know, with the research for the wine book, it's been
crazy.
So Italian. I've been drinking so much Italian wine, and I made it a point. I love French wines. I really love Spanish wines. I love some American wines. But I made it a point that since the first of this year, I'm going to drink Italian wine every single day. And
through now
I'm gonna go throughout the year, like, it's
so give me one or two things in the fridge or
I have to say I've not duplicated the wine and I've not gotten bored yet, so
wow.
it is
so you're drinking through everything.
I'm drinking through much Italian wine.
That's the answer. I mean, that makes sense to what you're doing. How about Joe Campanelli's favorite wine and food pairing? Not something you eat every night, not something every month, and not what you think is a good pairing, but what do you think works?
Yeah. My favorite pairing, honestly, is on Saturdays. My partner Alyssa and my son and I go to the farmer's market in Park Slope, and we get fish from our favorite fish purveyor called the Fish House. They're out of Montauk. They catch fish in the morning, bring it to the market, And then we'll cook fish. Either we'll like fry up some skate, or we'll do like bass with like roasted tomatoes and capers and olives, and open up a glass of usually Italian white wine, whether it's like Verdicchio or Pigato, and that sort of like midday lunch glass with
so
a fresh
nice
fish.
White fleshy fish, not necessarily, but you just described too. With a nice, white, crisp Italian. Pigato's like Vermentino, too, right?
Pigato's like Vermentino, yeah. Both so from those, Liguria.
Right. Terrific wines for that. All right, good answer. All right, third question. Favorite all-time wine? When I initially structured this question, the question was, what's the most expensive rare wine Joe ever drank? I could give a crap about that. The question is, what's that wine that was either the gateway or changed the way you thought about life, life-changing? I mean, this may go back to Florence or that wine store, or maybe even Italian wine merchants. What's that one or two wines?
Yeah, the wine that's really my favorite wine, it's the one that I drank the day the book was released, is the Poderi Le Boncier. And they used to call their wine Chianti Classico, but they've dropped out of the appellation since then. And I love this wine so much because when I was studying abroad in Florence as a sophomore in college, there was a wine store up the block from where I lived. And I went in once, bought a wine. It was delicious. And the purveyor was really nice. And then I went to a restaurant, bought a very expensive bottle of a famous name, Chianti. I'm not going to say the name, but I went back to the wine store and I told the owner, I was like, I drank this fancy Chianti last. I was like excited to share it with him. And he said to me, non è un vino vero. Like, that's not a real wine. Here, have this. And he gave me a bottle of Le Boncier Chianti Classico. And it's like, this is an artisan wine. This is a real wine. And it clicked.
Like, when you drank it, you got it right away?
When I drank it, I understood right. This was like a fraction of the price of the other wine. And it smelled like the trips that I made to Chianti. And I've always been searching for that, between that and, you know, the few producers I met on my trips to Chianti that felt connected to their land. I've always been searching for that.
That's the way you answer the question. I skipped the question, so we have to go back. Okay. You own a restaurant, you have crazy hours, you have a little kid now, you've been writing a book. But when you go out, if you go out or when you went out, favorite wine, restaurant, and or bar, who does it well? Like, I would answer Lalu. Great food, great wine, people who are picking the wine give a shit about it, the vibe is great. Who else outside of your spin is, you know, doing good stuff?
Thank you, Sam, for saying that about Lalu. You know, as you said, I had a kid, so I haven't, I had this this beautiful baby boy, and so we haven't been going out a ton. But when I do, it tends to be in Brooklyn and in our neighborhood. And we do have some really great wine programs, like Daniel Eddy at Runner Up. I love what Rebecca's doing at Red Hook Tavern. They had a fire they're about to open up soon. I'm excited about that. Four Horsemen.
Will Durney's place, yep.
Will Durney, yeah.
Four Horsemen is up for James Beard. Outstanding really? Wine program.
I'll be rooting for them.
With Frenchette, Jorge Riera from the Lake region. So those are all great ones. Anything else?
Popina. We just did our Fausto holiday party at Popina in their garden. So
the Irish Mafia making Italian food. O'Neill and McDade making Italian food. It's the funniest thing.
They're doing a great job.
Even though you had a Jewish mom, you have an Italian last name. So you have some credibility. Those are good ones. All right. Last question, and then we're going to taste wine. And we may have answered this, so there may be some backtracking, but think about it. Recommend to me the best wine around $15, $20, $22. Recommend a red and a white. Let me think. I just blacked out. So my kids are in their 20s. They can't afford, you know, $40 wines. They're not going to buy supermarket wine, industrial wine. So what would you recommend in that price range? I know Sicily may have fit it, but, you know, either backtrack or give me some new stuff.
Yeah. I would say for whites, it's hard to go wrong with Verdicchio, especially this producer, Chloe Stefano.
So Verdicchio is a varietal.
It's a varietal.
It's great. And a maker?
Chloe Stefano.
C-O-L-L-I?
C-O-L-L-E-S-T-F-A-N-O. Okay. But I think that's a little bit more of an obvious answer. Maybe Herba Luce, I mentioned before.
It's not obvious because people are looking at guys like you to get in that range. So Herba Luce and Chloe Stefano.
Herba Luce is a grape from northern Piedmont, especially near the town of near Carema, and there's more and more producers coming in of that. And Grand Cru has a good
one. Who's a good Herba Luce producer?
There's one from Grand Cru Imports called Cheek, C-I-E-C-K, I believe it's pronounced.
Okay,
or it's spelled.
And it's in that price range.
In that price range.
Okay,
too.
So how about red?
And then red, we spoke about Schiavo. How about, I know that when James was on the show, he mentioned Rosese, which I love.
I think he brought one in.
I love that one. There's so many good
Where's Rosese from?
From Liguria also.
Right, right. It's that, doesn't get the props, but it's a great, you know, wine from that region.
Yeah.
Let's go with that. Nothing wrong with that.
I love Rosese. How about let's do a new one.
Go ahead.
Let's we spoke about Chesanese. Yes. Okay, let's stick with Rosese.
What is it?
Let's do Pella Verga. How about that?
Okay. And I'll put Chesanese in. I'll listen and say, previous to this question, we talked about these good value wines. So we have plenty of stuff.
Okay.
All right. That's the five questions. I thought this was a dumb opportunity to ask you a stupid question.
Okay.
So the question is, because you just devoted a couple of years of your life focused on Italian wines. Desert Island Italian wine. Boom, you're stuck on an island. You get one, maybe two wines. We talked about 20 regions, emerging wines, winemakers. And hopefully this doesn't box you in like Ariane Acapinti doesn't say, how come you didn't say my wine? So how do you answer that question?
I think the one that comes right to my mind is Valentini Trebbiano d'Abruzzo.
Okay, that's a beauty.
Oh, I'd love that wine all year round.
Okay.
I love it young. I love it old. That is, I think, one of the great wines in the world.
So then we're going to... That's a terrific answer in all senses. All right. Last and final feature, weekly wine sip. We taste a different wine on air every week. Usually winemakers bring in their wines. Certainly guys like you who just wrote a book, own a restaurant, buy wines. It's nice for you to ask. I appreciate that you brought a wine in. So this week... Set up this wine for me. It's a Miccia Cirque, and take it from there.
Yeah, Miccia is a friend of mine. His family owns a great restaurant and in Friuli. And Miccia is a young guy. He started making wine with Jasko Grosvenor, and he's 13 years old. He's been all around the world. He's worked at Dujac, at Rouleau. He worked at 11 Madison Park here in New York.
And he plays good?
Yeah, just the best. Conterno. He worked with Roberto Conterno everywhere. He's made his first wines were orange wines, and now he's making these sort of like really crisp, clean, beautiful wines. And to me, this is exactly the kind of wine that I love. It is the most natural possible. It's all organic. There's no sulfur in some vintages, but in the glass, it is as fresh and drinkable and clean and expressive as you could ever want.
So let's talk specifics. The name of does this wine have a name?
Yeah.
Is it?
Let me just make sure. Yeah, it just calls it the Miccia Cirque Bianco.
I wanted
to make sure that I was right.
It's a Miccia Cirque Bianco. What's the vintage year on this one?
This one's 2020.
2020. And what is the grape, Joe?
And it's all Friulano.
It's Friulano.
100%.
Okay. All right. So let's do some evaluation. The color is kind of a mid beautiful gold, right?
Yeah.
It's not light, not deep, but it's really beautiful color. I leave it to you. Let's put it up to the schnoz. What do you get on the nose?
To me, it's mostly minerality and a little bit of a floral note. I have to say, like since my days doing all of the WSET and CMS and all that, which is a long time ago, I'm less good or less interested in like the particular flavor, you know, the flavor.
Also
notes.
Sitting in front of diapers for 2 years.
Yeah.
Right.
try to smell less. So yeah, that's, right.
All right. So but there were a couple. Mouthfeel. I think we get kind of a medium, you know, it's not a thin wine. It's not unctuous. It's a beautiful feel in the mouth. Right. Mm-hmm.
And just like this really this acidity that is persistent, like you keep feeling it, but it's not too sharp at any point, right?
I think when you get to the palate, you talk about acidity, but when you get to mouthfeel, you get that nice medium feel, and you get that acidity right now. What about the palate? Does the palate reflect any of the stuff you said on the nose?
Yeah, I think it continues to be sort of a mineral-driven, lightly floral wine. Some stone fruit characteristic, but this is a little like bitter almond that I guess you're not picking up on the nose.
Yes.
Because that's a little more of a mouthfeel thing too. And like a yellow, like a not super juicy pear, like a yellow,
right.
But not like the ripest yellow pear.
Those are.
And what I like about it too is it's 12.5% alcohol. And so it's not going to knock you over the head. Right. It's a wine
you can drink couple of bottles through a meal,
yeah.
Have it complement the food and not knock you out.
Exactly.
Which is a nice thing. What would we pair this with?
Ooh. Oh, it's so versatile.
So one of the answers, it's versatile.
It's versatile.
So it's not boxed into.
And, you know, that's what I'm usually looking for when choosing wines because, you know, I don't work in a tasting menu restaurant and I don't live in a tasting menu house either, so it's usually you need one wine to kind of make it through the meal. But I think anything from,
so you know what may be easier, what doesn't it go with, like what, asparagus? I mean, what probably goes with asparagus?
Yeah, well, so Friulano is also known as Sauvignon Vert or Sauvignonese, and it has some green notes that could complement asparagus. I think asparagus might be good. Maybe if you have like a really meat, like you're doing like a bistecca fiorentina or
too much.
It's not too much. Yeah.
So it shows you the versatility of it. Pretty much everything but a big bloody red Tuscan steak or Florentine steak or something. All right. So that is the Miccia Cirque Bianco 2020, you said?
2020.
All right, and I will post that. I didn't mention that I will post your wine list answers on our social media, and I will also post the wine that we're drinking. Joe, we have to wrap up. We ran very long. Matt's giving me the boogie eyes, so we got to get out of here. But before we do that, let me just do a quick wrap-up. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Please subscribe, because when you subscribe, you wake up the next day and there's Joe Campanelli in bed with you with his new book telling you about what Italian wines you should be drinking. I mean, why wouldn't you subscribe, okay? Another issue, another show. All right, follow us on Instagram @SBenRuby and on Twitter @BenRuby. I know it could be confusing, but you can always use the hashtag TheGrapeNation to find us on both. At Facebook, we're @TheGrapeNation. Like I mentioned, we'll post Joe's wine list and weekly wine sip on our social media sites. Joe, let's break down a little intel here. Where can we find your new book? We always encourage people to go to independent booksellers, right? You just did a signing where, like last night or a day?
I appreciate it. Yeah. The independent seller that has in New York is Powerhouse Books. They have a location in Dumbo. They have one in Park Slope and one in Industry City. The book's at a bunch of wine retail stores like Slope Cellars and Leon & Sons. My website, joecampanelli.com, has links to the different retailers that have it. And then also our restaurants, Lalu and Fausto, you can buy signed copies through the restaurants. So if you go to the website, lalubrooklyn.com or faustobrooklyn.com, you can buy signed copies through the restaurants.
Joe, if I live 14 miles outside of Kansas City, Missouri, I could order it on Amazon?
For sure.
Okay.
You can also order it from Fausto or Lalu. We'll send it there. Yeah.
So go to Fausto or Lalu first. Support Joe. And then, Joe, if we want to follow you, the restaurants on social media, where can we go?
Yeah, we're on predominantly on Instagram. Lalu is at Lalu Brooklyn.
L-A-L-O-U.
And then Brooklyn spelled out.
The word Brooklyn, not word BKL Brooklyn. Brooklyn.
And then Fausto is at Fausto Brooklyn.
F-A-U-S-T-O. Brooklyn.
Brooklyn spelled out. And then my personal is at Joe Campanelli. And so okay. You can find book events that I'm doing through my personal.
So it's an exciting time to stay on top of Joe because of the book and what he's doing and signings. And the restaurants are more than established, so it'd be fun to go on those sites too. So I recommend that. Joe, we got a roll. I want to thank our guest, Joe Campanelli. Thanks to our engineer, as always, Matt, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benrubi, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.